Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Tulane University professor T.R. Johnson, editor of New Orleans A Literary History. It's a pleasure to welcome T.R. Johnson to The Reading Life. T.R. is a professor of English and Wise Presidential Fellow at Tulane University. You might also know him from his long-running radio program, Jazz from the French Market, which airs Tuesdays from 4 to 7 on WWOZ. Today we're talking about his new book, New Orleans, A Literary History, a collection of 27 essays by insightful scholars with great expertise on the city's literary past and present. T.R., welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's a thrill to be here.
So tell us a little bit about how this book came about, because it's a big one.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a while in the making. Shortly after Hurricane Katrina, the chair of the English department at Tulane asked me if I'd be interested in taking over a course called Literary New Orleans. It had been taught for decades by a colleague of mine named Dale Edmonds. He was retiring after the storm. And somebody needed to teach this class. And she said, would you be interested in doing this? I said, I would love to pick it up and run with it. And so that's what I did. And I probably taught it almost once a year for ever since 2006. And with each sort of pass through, I sort of refined it and tinkered with it and added some things and, you know, figuring out how to fit into a 15-week semester, all the stuff I wanted to get into. That was what went on for, you know, over a decade. And then about 2.5 years ago, Cambridge University Press approached me kind of out of the blue and said, we're interested in doing a book on the literary history of the city. We understand that you're the person who teaches this course at Tulane. Would you be interested in developing a book like this? I said, I absolutely would love to. So I set about the task then. That was March of 2017. Wrote them an introduction, wrote them a proposal first, and then a kind of hypothetical table of contents, and started contacting people who would give me essays on these various topics, and slowly but surely it began to come together. And then about a year ago this week, I turned it into Cambridge, and after a very busy fall of 2018, sort of putting this thing together, and turned it in about this time last year, and it just came out this fall.
Now, you had to make some really tough choices, because there's so much choose from.
That's
so
right.
So talk about that, those dilemmas
it's an impossible dilemma, really, to get everything in here. The riches, the literary riches of this city can't possibly be fit into a single volume. What I kind of hit upon about midway through my thinking about this stuff was, what I need to do is only include literature that played a really significant role in how the world has come to imagine this city. So, for example, while Truman Capote, for example, is from here, he never really wrote anything about it that's super duper important to the way people understand this place. And there went Truman Capote. And there were the list, I think in the preface, I give a kind of about a 4-line list of people who, these are all major literary figures who either lived here long enough or grew up here to call the place home. And yet they never engaged it as a topic in ways that sort of altered or added to the way the world understands the place. And so I didn't end up doing a chapter on them. That became then kind of a way of making it manageable in a single volume.
Sure.
And because while there's so much, so many people have come from here, spent time here, I think, honestly, just about every major American writer of the last 150 years has spent at least some time here thinking about this place. I couldn't get into all of them. It would just become impossible. But I zeroed in on those works that really are fundamental to how the world understands the place, or that were shaped and influenced kind of implicitly by this place in such an overwhelming way that it needed to be in there. And so that was how I began. That was sort of the first rubric, as it were, that mm-hmm. or the first kind of guideline that allowed me to start making this a manageable single volume study. Cambridge was very strict on the word limit, and so I couldn't spill over by a single word. So that became the real, for me as editor, the art of this thing was figuring out how to squeeze as much as I could into those narrow confines. So there's a lot of stuff in it, but it would be interesting to think about if I had taken sort of a different framework. It would, I'm sure, be a 3 or 4 volume study.
Oh, it could be easily. Yeah. And I just love that you started with the swamp, where we all came from, literally.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful essay by Anthony Wilson.
That's right.
And I love the idea of swamp discourse.
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
Cheers me up enormously. So talk. I'm in swamp discourse now. So talk a little bit about that.
It is so interesting, and I'm glad you picked up on that. Early on, I decided to make that kind of the lead-off essay, with the idea that the kind of primordial ooze that was here before there was any attempt at human settlement here, and that arguably will be what's here long after this area is uninhabitable, it's the kind of natural starting place. It's the given, the MacGuffin, Hitchcock would say, that is a kind of first principle in structuring everything that's ever happened here ever since. And that may be a bold and kind of wild claim, but I think I stick by it. The swamps were a smuggler's paradise. Mm-hmm. And, my colleague Larry Powell at Tulane in Accidental City has a lot to say about the ways, particularly through the 1700s, the economy of this region was so dominated by smuggling, stuff that couldn't be taxed, that it was a major issue for anybody trying to govern this place, that the taxable commerce of this city was a tiny fraction of the actual commerce of the city. And this was all a function of the swamps. A zillion hiding places, a zillion escape routes, a zillion places of ingress into the city. And so it made the place in many ways kind of ungovernable. You can't really enforce laws in a swamp because people just scatter and hide. And not only a smuggler's paradise, but of course a constant, and Anthony Wilson talks about this as well, a constant invitation to the enslaved to run and hide, if they could imagine ways to do that. And so it was this just, not a long distance from the heart of the slave markets was a terrain that was kind of the antithesis of the slave market, a place where a kind of supreme freedom was imaginable. If you had the knowledge and the wherewithal to navigate that environment, you would live a kind of pure and pristine freedom, like something out of the Garden of Eden, in theory, if you knew how to eat and survive in such an environment. Despite its ostensible perils, snakes and gators whatever. And so the swamp was, it seems to me, the essential starting place for how this city has come to know itself and sort of be imagined. When the French first got here, nicknaming it the Wet Grave, they were referring to its swampiness. A penal colony, sort of a nasty place for nasty people, was how it was initially kind of framed as the French began to put people here. And the European settlement got rolling. But that seemed to me to be the natural starting place, a place where land and water are always mixing in these kind of indeterminate ways, and thus as a kind of natural metaphor for the other kinds of mixings that New Orleans was exceptional for, race mixing and all of the kind of super complex social collisions and mixings and hybridizings that have happened here from early on.
And that primordial ooze pops up in books as recent as Nathaniel Rich's King Zeno, mud is practically a character. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, one of the things that is fun about this book is that the essays are in dialogue with each other.
That's right.
And you're always picking up little echoes here and there. And I think readers will come away with a stronger sense of what writers like George Washington Cable and Grace King contributed to the civic dialogue at their time.
Oh, essential. Yeah. When I think about, literary New Orleans, the idea that there is a literature with a capital L of this city, it's impossible to overstate the significance of Grace King to that, running that salon and very deliberately situating this place as a major intellectual hub. If it had not been for Grace King, I don't know that the kind of the modernist movement here with the double dealer, Faulkner and Sherwood Anderson, would have taken root, roughly 30 years later after her salon really got going. And so it's really significant their interest in particular on a vision of a kind of a heritage. Cable and King in particular, also drawing from Charles Garay, sort of the original historian of this place, a gorgeous prose stylist, a beautiful writer and storyteller of this place's early settlement and development and the intrigue and the complexities of the efforts to govern and situate this place as a permanent settlement, given the troubles of flooding and storms and plagues and so on. And so they are essential to the very idea of a capital L literary New Orleans.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with T.R. Johnson, editor of New Orleans, A Literary History. Well, one of the things that interests me about this literature and these circles in particular is that a lot of this sprang from resistance. You know, Richard Watson Gilder comes to town and says to Grace King, well, if Cable is so false to you, why do not some of you write better? And it's a terrific goat for her.
That's right.
And The Double Dealer also motivated by resistance of Mencken's, dismissive ideas of the South.
That's right.
And then after Katrina.
That's right.
We're all out there going, listen.
Yeah.
Listen to what this place has to say to you.
Exactly.
So.
Absolutely. That notion of New Orleans kind of resisting and pushing back against a kind of dismissal from the North that, the South is just a broken and lost place, a moral shame and so on, and nothing comes from there of any quality or significance. And clearly, you just checked the boxes there, that the Double Dealer, they bold intervention in that idea, insisting that this is a major, major cultural hub, a hemispheric hub, a gateway between different worlds. I learned so much, in thinking about the Spanish language tradition of the city, and this major modernist magazine of that period called El Mercurio, publishing, using cutting edge photography technology to publish these incredible images and all of this, really extraordinary cutting edge writing for the world south of here. That in itself suggests that this place is so much more complex than sort of neighboring cities in the region with which an outsider might lump them in. Jackson, New Orleans, Houston, Baton Rouge, they're all the same kind of place. Well, clearly not at all.
Well, talk a little bit more about that, because I found that particularly fascinating.
Incredible, isn't it? I mean, we often, the extraordinary tradition of the French here and the long-standing kind of dialogue and dynamics between white and black, and that has dominated so much of the cultural discussion of New Orleans that it seems to me that a very rich and extraordinary Spanish language tradition kind of gets bypassed. I mean, obviously the Spanish were here as colonialists for 30-odd years at the end of the 1700s, and their indelible footprint on the place is essential to understanding the history. But what people, I think, kind of forget is how much it continued to play such an amazing role. One of the points that particular essay by Kirsten Groos points out is that, long before Houston was Houston and Miami was Miami, we were that gateway to the Southern Hemisphere. New Orleans was the Miami, the Houston, in terms of commerce, in terms of cultural exchange. In the 20th century, we think of, the United Fruit Company, rooted here and was a global player in the politics and economics of that whole region of Central America. And the Stone Center for Latin American Studies at Tulane becomes, too, a kind of a hub for this 20th century interface between New Orleans and major points south.
And it's a catalyst for research.
Absolutely
All you have to do is visit the Latin American Library at Tulane for a crash course.
Absolutely. You walk through those doors and you've entered a special space. It doesn't look like the rest of the library.
Right.
And it's almost, you feel like you're in the foyer of a museum, in fact. And it historically I mean, it deserves, I think, that kind of distinction. What it has meant through the 20th century, certainly since, you know, the 40s and 50s, its role is incredible. Thinking about the modernist era here, and even in our own, you know, this particular chapter of post-Katrina New Orleans, we all know how much Spanish-speaking labor contributed to the physical reconstruction of the city. And so today, just as much as the 1920s, just as much as the 1780s, there is a really significant Spanish dimension to the city. One of the things that essay points out that I think is such a wonderful point is that when people visit New Orleans from north of here, they're always stunned by how different it is. It's so different. But when people visit from points south, the shock is one of recognition. It's like, my God, it's just like home,
right,
would say someone from Veracruz or Havana. And that is something that I think North American audiences tend to forget, is that this is a natural stopping point for anyone coming from south, and it feels a lot like home. And that's a fascinating thing. Back to your original question, that makes this city really kind of exceptional and thus spurs the resistant gestures of a Grace King, for example. Mm-hmm. It really gets traction pretty fast when you think about this place in a hemispheric context, not a quote-unquote regional context.
Well, one of the other things about this book is that you have all the well-known figures. Well, not all of them, but, you know, right, almost all of them. Kate Chopin, Faulkner, sure, Tennessee Williams, Robert Penn Warren, Walker Percy, John Kennedy Toole.
Yeah.
Did you learn anything new? Were there any surprises in the essays about those particular, the standards?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. You know, the first one you mentioned, Kate Chopin, I thought that's a stunning essay by Emily Toth. That starts off with
who
this.
Who is the Kate Chopin
scholar? Oh, absolutely.
Scholar.
Absolutely. She is it. And she starts off that essay in this really stunning, provocative way, talking about the main character of the book, Edna Pontellier. She says, is Edna Pontellier stupid? And it's an incredibly, I was like, whoa, I did not expect that. And of course, it becomes a very interesting question. And what she ultimately suggests, and this is a completely, for me, a totally new way of understanding that book, it's not that Edna is stupid, it's that she's lonely and has very little opportunity for stimulating conversation. And for a woman in that period to have no opportunities for sort of sisterly discussions of serious mm-hmm. things, she's not then allowed to develop intellectually, and this ultimately becomes a spur to her despair. And of course, Emily Toth also suggests that ending is ambiguous, that it is not necessarily a suicide, but maybe just some kind of mystical vanishing. We just don't know. An incredibly provocative. I've always read that book the exact same way, and it had over and over through the years, not at all the way Emily Toth has opened up to me, that this is a story of loneliness, of what happens to a really bright woman who has no chance to develop her mind through conversation. And we don't actually know how it ends, and are foolish to suppose we do.
I'm always hoping Edna's out there swimming.
Of course, of course.
Now, another thing that you have to do in a book like this is give certain people their proper weight and mm-hmm. reevaluate them mm-hmm. as they are being reevaluated mm-hmm. over time. And two of the figures that struck me as being so beautifully treated in this anthology were, first, Louis Armstrong getting his due as a writer.
Yeah, yeah. Incredible stuff. And I learned a lot from that one, too. Daniel Stein, a scholar based in Germany who's done incredible work on Armstrong, he is very attuned to what we sometimes have been calling lately the new sound studies, mm-hmm. people getting interested in what certain places and certain times sounded like. If you were in New Orleans in 1910, what would you have been hearing on the street? That's particularly important to Armstrong because for Armstrong, in his sort of narration of his life, what his life was all about, as he said, music is my life, he wants to explain the way the sounds of the city shaped who he was. In a very significant way, the what we call the vendor's cries, you know, the,
yes,
you know, the, I got your cantaloupe, I got your bananas, that kind of stuff, the pie man, the scrap iron man, all of them being so important to him. But also just the sounds of the city, and sound as a kind of subtle metaphor of something that can move freely over barriers. You know, if someone is playing a trumpet in the next room, we're going to hear it, mm-hmm. obviously. And that ability to sort of move through walls is a very powerful metaphor for what, as a young African-American genius, he was most interested in figuring out how to do, overcoming the very narrow confines that he was sort of born into in the rough back-of-town part of New Orleans at the dawn of the 20th century. An incredible study, and I had never thought of Armstrong or that book that way. And making a place for Armstrong's memoirs in the literary history of the city strikes me as a way to open up what we mean by storytelling and what we imagine to be the languages of power in the city. And that's why I wanted to make sure I got Armstrong in there, because I think his memoirs are fascinating and more complex even than I had initially supposed. And it opens up dimensions of the city that are not traditionally included in a literary history of the city, in the way I'm thinking of Grace King, George Cable, kind of a certain traditional main line of descent. I wanted to open up something that would bring fresh perspectives on those periods and some of the tensions and energies that were in play as various sort of selves began to constitute themselves through the various means available to them.
Welcome back. I'm talking with T.R. Johnson, editor of New Orleans, A Literary History. We have to talk a little bit about Kevin Rabelais' wonderful essay about Hurricane Katrina, which touches on, you know, more recent work and work, I think, that is still forthcoming.
That's right. You know? That's right. Absolutely. You know, that essay was, I knew it was going to be a really tough one to write because, A, there's so much stuff came out. There's just a flood of writing about Hurricane Katrina and the flood that followed. And it's such painful territory for New Orleanians of our time who have lived it so closely. I'd been living here about 6 years when it happened, and it was hard on me. So lifelong natives, it's unimaginable. Mm-hmm. And so I had to do really some hard thinking about who would I offer this assignment to. And I knew Kevin Rabelais to be a tremendous reader and a very, very thoughtful person who would do the very tough, judicious work of deciding where to put the emphases. And because there's a mountain of writing about the stuff, a flood is the better metaphor,
yeah,
I guess.
Of course.
Where to put the focus, some tough calls have to get made. And I knew Kevin could do it. And so I was really, really pleased with how he handled that virtually impossible assignment. There's so much pain in those works. I'm thinking of One Dead in the Attic, you know, Chris Rose, and the apocalypse that we witnessed firsthand and that has also become a kind of grim template for how a lot of us think about the future here. That's not the last time we're going to see 12 feet of water in these streets and mile after mile of carnage. At least we keep telling ourselves that, and I think that's right. And so it's that literature is very important as a kind of touchstone of what we need to keep in our minds as we move into the future here.
Well, you have this symposium coming up.
I do.
So talk a little bit about what's in store for folks at that event.
Yes, please. Open to the public. Anybody can come. This is on Saturday, January 25th. So it's coming up really soon. Saturday, January 25th starts at 9 o'clock in the morning and goes to 6 o'clock in the evening. It is called a Symposium on the Literary History of New Orleans. It's in the LBC, the Lavin Burnick Center up at Tulane, right in the exact center of Tulane campus. We'll be in the Stibbs Conference Room of the LBC there at the center of Tulane's campus. We're going to have four panels, each devoted to a different cluster of essays in the book. So there'll be a full panel of the contributors who wrote the essays about 18th and 19th century New Orleans. Be about eight or nine people. Frederick Starr, who wrote about Lafcadio Hearn, Matt Smith on George Cable, Emily Toth on Kate Chopin, all these scholars on all the 18th and 19th century stuff will be there talking about that, the first 150-odd years of the writing of the city. The second panel will be on 20th and 21st century literature, also, again, about eight or nine people, talking about the canonical classics, but also these new and emerging stars, and putting all of that into dialogue. Well, then, after a lunch break, we'll have a panel called Literary Legacies of Color, where we get into the Asian American New Orleans story, which is its own really
another
fascinating
chapter,
subject.
Right.
Absolutely. And Kalama will be on that panel talking about Tom Dent, and there'll be the engagement with the essays on Armstrong and Brock Coupe, the mythic folkloric figure who allegedly invented jazz, and all that territory will be in that panel. And then the final panel is going to be called Land, Weather, Water, and What Next? And that will be...
Always the question.
Yeah, exactly. So that'll be the stuff that's kind of keyed and calibrated to, broadly speaking, environmental concerns. We'll have the essay on swamps, of course, in there. Kevin Rabelais' essay on Katrina. My essay on climate change. Marguerite Nguyen's essay about the Vietnamese of New Orleans East and their extraordinary gardening tradition. And,
oh, yes.
You know, remarkable stuff. And several others. And with each panel, there will be a pair of interviewers and responders who will be posing questions and responses to the chapters by way of getting discussions going. So this will be people like Larry Powell, Bernice McFadden, Sally Tarefa, Rebecca Snedeker, Charisma Price. It should be a lot of fun.
A lot to talk about.
That's right.
For sure.
That's Saturday, January 25th in the LBC at Tulane Stibbs Conference Room. The very next Saturday, February 1st at Melba's, they're going to give away 100 copies of the book. So if you really want to get a copy of the book, but the price tag is feeling a little bit prohibitive, go to Melba's on Saturday, February 1st at noon, and I will hand you one for free. I think
get
you have to buy a daiquiri, a tobo. That's right. You got to get a po' boy or a daiquiri, and I'll give you a book.
That's the way to start.
It's a New Orleans
new
happy
year.
Meal.
It's really great.
I'm calling it the New Orleans happy meal.
That's a very happy meal. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with T.R. Johnson, who's the editor of New Orleans, A Literary History. Thanks.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Jason Lee discusses and signs God Must Have Forgotten Me, Wednesday, January 22nd at 5 at Barnes & Noble West Bank. One Book, One New Orleans kicks off with an inaugural lecture by Kalamu Yassalam, editor of this year's selection, New Orleans Griot, the Tom Dent Reader. That's Thursday, January 23rd at 5 at the University of New Orleans, Earl K. Long Library, Room 407. All are welcome. Country music historian and former Tulane University professor Bill C. Malone discusses and signs his book, Country Music USA, and his work on Ken Burns' documentary series, Country Music. That's Thursday, January 23rd at 7 at the New Orleans Jazz Museum at the Old U.S. Mint, 400 Esplanade Avenue. Local poet and educator Carolyn Hembree presents poets Chanel Clark, Shana Monet, and Chioma Arama, who will read from their work Thursday, January 23rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Daniel Pardee, Richard E. Greenlee Fellow at the Latin American Library at Tulane University, presents a lecture, Bolero Jazz, Stories of a Musical Rendezvous, with music by the Javier Olando Quartet, Friday, January 24th at 7 at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, 1205 North Rampart Street. T.R. Johnson, the editor and contributors to the new anthology, New Orleans, A Literary History, present a symposium on the literary history of New Orleans, starting at 9:15 a.m. Saturday, January 25th, at the Lavin Burnick Center at Tulane University, and concluding at 6:30. Maurice Ruffin presents keynote remarks at 4:30, followed by a reception. This is open to the public. The Neighborhood Story Project hosts a book release celebration for Return to Yaakni Chito, Home of Migrations, photographs and essays by Monique Verdin, with an opening essay by Houma historian and philosopher Michael Darter, poems by Ray Moose Jackson, stories by ArtSpot Productions director Kathy Randalls, and Mondo Bizarro director, co-director Nick Sly. The event takes place Sunday, January 26th at 2 at the Neighborhood Story Project, 2202 La Perouse Street. Blue Cypress Books presents an afternoon with Alexis Breaux discussing and signing her new children's book, Cordelia's Key, Sunday, January 26th at 2:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Tickets available on Facebook and at Eventbrite. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org.